I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll look at the decline of diner culture in America. First, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke for nearly an hour in Philadelphia today on the merits of the proposed nuclear deal with Iran. The address at the National Constitution Center came as the Obama administration appears to have garnered enough support in the Senate to keep the agreement intact. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
The proposed deal has been condemned by Republicans in Congress and hammered in television ads. Kerry's speech was at times detailed, even technical, explaining that monitoring systems in the deal incorporate lessons from experience with North Korea. He also answered the charge that under the agreement, Iran could build a secret weapons facility because it can delay inspections of suspicious sites for as long as 24 days.
In truth, there is no way in 24 days or 24 months, in 24 years, to destroy all the evidence of illegal activity that has been taking place regarding fissile material. Because of the nature of fissile materials, you can't eliminate the evidence by shoving it under a mattress, flushing it down a toilet, carting it off in the middle of the night.
Other arguments were more straightforward.
None of the problems that we are concerned about will be made easier if it is rejected. None of them. Not Iran's nuclear program, not Iran's support for terrorism, not its human rights record, and not its opposition to Israel. To oppose this agreement is, whether intended or not, to recommend a policy of national paralysis.
If Congress votes to reject the treaty, as things now stand, the Obama administration appears to have enough support in the Senate to sustain a veto of such a move. Kerry would like to get more. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Just released this afternoon, a pedestrian map for those intending to come to Philadelphia during Pope Francis's visit later this month. Let's follow the path with WHYY's Tom McDonald. And Tom, for many, it's a more restricted path than previously revealed.
Well, Dave, we were under the impression that it was all going to be first come, first screened, first to the papal altar. It's not that way. A map that was issued by the Secret Service this afternoon shows that from 20th Street to the Art Museum, which is where the altar is going to be, it's for ticketed holders only, those with tickets issued by the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Those people are basically people who are in the parishes, the social service of the Archdiocese, and also some other people who Pope Francis has touched the lives of so deeply. Now, there's also a second location. That location is at Independence Hall. 5,000 tickets will be made available for the general public. The rest of the tickets will be given to people who have been part of the parish system. So if you want a ticket, there is going to be an online lottery, and that is for the Independence Hall tickets only. That will be on Tuesday. The information on how you can participate in that lottery will be made available on Friday, Dave.
What news do we have about the number of screening areas and entry points?
Well, there's going to be 7 screening points available for people who have tickets, 3 for those who don't. So that means even if you are in the back, you're going to have to wait longer for your screening than you will if you have the coveted tickets.
The Secret Service apparently announced a list of items that will and will not be allowed. And Tom, you're going to have to leave your selfie stick at home.
Yeah, no selfie sticks, no drones, no glass, thermal, or metal containers, no laser pointers, no mace or pepper spray. And also, if you want to make a sign for the Pope, it has to be smaller than 5x3 and made of cardboard, poster board, or cloth.
How about bags or backpacks?
You can bring in some of those things, but the problem is you've got to make the backpack small, and that's 18x13x7. If you want to bring a cooler, make sure it's a soft-sided cooler. You can't wheel your hard cooler from your car onto the parkway.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Dave.
WHYY's Tom McDonald reporting. In other news today, another fight has emerged between Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey and rank-and-file officers. This one's over whether the names of officers involved in shootings should be released to the public. The city's police union is now taking a big swing by pushing legislation in Harrisburg to overrule Ramsey. Details from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
The U.S. Department of Justice recently issued 91 recommendations to the Philadelphia Police Department. One was to start releasing the names of officers involved in shootings with suspects. The feds pointed out that the public sometimes waits many months after a shooting to learn the details, and sometimes an officer's identity is still kept under wraps, undermining the community's trust. So Ramsey this summer reversed the long-standing policy of withholding an officer's name. Now names are released 3 days after an incident, as long as there's no threat to an officer's safety. The head of the police union, John McNesby, wants to put that to a stop.
It makes it a little bit more difficult today because you actually have to look over your shoulder. We have families too. We're not asking, you know, for the world. We're asking for fairness.
McNesby asked freshman State Representative Martina White to sponsor a bill keeping identities of officers who fire their weapons secret to avoid harassment and possible attacks. At a press conference packed with cheering officers, White said the measure already has 41 co-sponsors in the Republican-controlled legislature. Ramsey says if the bill passes, he'll call on Governor Tom Wolf to veto it.
I understand the concern if there's threats being made, and if that's the case, we won't release the name. But barring that, I don't see any reason for that not to happen.
The DOJ has said a series of reforms, including more training for police on when to use a weapon, is needed to ease, quote, significant strife that exists between police and the community. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
In Pennsylvania, a very tardy state budget is pinching school districts that depend on those dollars to open their doors. Some are sacrificing programs or taking out loans. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has this story from Chester Upland, a district in Delaware County where the staff is working without pay.
So with the ringing of the bell, we will officially open our 2015-2016 school year.
Local officials welcomed students back to Chester Upland schools this morning with bells and talk of bucking up in the face of the district's financial challenges. Here's State Representative Thaddeus Kirkland.
I know that a lot of people think that we're going through some struggles, and we are. I know that a lot of people want Chester Upland to fail. Well, they've been wanting Chester Upland to fail for the past 20-plus years. And each and every time, we've risen like the phoenix.
The small city of Chester and its school district, Chester Upland, have been financially distressed for more like 25 years. The struggles Kirkland's talking about now include relying on the state for most of Chester Upland's funding, when the state budget is missing in action, and extra high charter school tuition payments for special education students. What leaders didn't mention by name was how the financial burden has landed on Chester Upland staff, including teacher Daria Jackson.
You get the construction paper, and it has letters A through Z.
The day before students returned, Jackson, who's a special education teacher, was putting the finishing touches on her classroom at Stetzer Elementary School.
Then I have a display here, lights, camera, action. We are learning with Ms. Jackson, so that's where I'm going to post students' samples of work.
Like a lot of teachers, Jackson pays for many of her classroom materials out of pocket. Unlike a lot of teachers, she doesn't know when she'll see her first paycheck this year. With no state funding trickling down to schools, last week district officials told staff they couldn't make payroll. The staff voted to come back to work anyway.
When we first make the decision, it's like, wait, did we just say that? But we know what we're doing. Like, we've done this before.
In the course of Chester Upland's budget struggles, this isn't the first time it's run out of money. But it is the first time the state hasn't been in a position to bail it out. That leaves many districts where money is tight in a holding pattern, says Jackson.
We're first in line, but, you know, who's behind us? There's a lot of school districts that's right behind us, so it's tough. It's tough.
Philadelphia is in the process of taking out a $275 million loan to pay for some of its expenses until state dollars start flowing. Another school district cut payments to charter schools while waiting for Harrisburg to act. Earlier this year, Democratic Governor Tom Wolf tried to push through a budget that would have added $400 million to education funding, paid for by taxing things like shale gas drilling. The legislature unanimously rejected Wolf's budget. In return, Wolf vetoed a Republican-authored plan. Steve Miskin is a spokesman for the House Republican Caucus.
The hardest hit right now are those most reliant of state and federal dollars. And they're the ones, you know, the governor's full veto is hitting them smack on the chin.
Supporters of the governor's budget proposal say it was necessary to restore dwindling education dollars. Here's Jeff Sheridan, a spokesman for Governor Wolf.
The governor's budget proposal took a hugely important first step in restoring the funds that were cut by Republicans over the last 4 years.
State leaders on both sides say they're sorry, but it's the other guy's fault that Chester Upland teachers aren't getting paid. The teachers don't care whose fault it is. As Chester Upland opened its doors for the first day of school, members of the teachers union handed out flyers asking parents to call their local legislators, urging them to go back to Harrisburg and pass a budget.
All right, man, we're just saying thank you to the teachers for coming to work. Call it, look on the back of the number, find your state rep, and have them call there and pass their budget.
All right.
But Miskin says the Capitol leadership doesn't feel that pressure yet.
Today, no. But it will.
In the meantime, Chester Upland teacher Daria Jackson is accentuating the positive.
Well, as of right now, as you see, our lights are on, the water's running, so everyone's getting prepared. You can see everyone's ready, and we're hopeful, and I believe everything will work out eventually.
For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, New Jersey Senate President Steve Sweeney today called on Governor Christie to sign legislation modernizing laws governing state elections. The measure would establish in-person early voting, enact automatic voter registration when residents apply for driver's licenses, and authorize pre-registration for 17-year-olds, among other measures. Christie has yet to take action on the bill since it passed in June. A new standardized test linked to Common Core academic standards is proving to be a challenge for Delaware school students. First-year results from the Smarter Balance test released today show that on average, barely half of Delaware students who tested are proficient in English language arts. Statewide, less than 40% of students scored proficiency in math. Despite the results, Governor Jack Markell and outgoing Education Secretary Mark Murphy say Delaware students did better than expected based on a nationwide field test of more than 4 million students in Delaware as well as 20 other states taken last spring. 91 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:18. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clearing skies overnight, low 72 degrees. Tomorrow starts off sunny. Partly sunny in the afternoon, humid. Thursday's high, 92. Still ahead, an art piece made entirely from weapons and shell casings is stuck in U.S. Customs.
I mean, he's taking things that were used to kill and maim people, and he's trying to make them to objects of beauty or to make you think about things that happened in this country and moving on from that war.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. The world-renowned Toneel Group Amsterdam reimagine After the Rehearsal and Persona, two screenplays by Ingmar Bergman about the meaning of theater and art in our lives and society. The show features a 10,000-gallon pool of water and powerful emotional and physical performances to match the layered psychological drama of Bergman's text. On stage this week only as part of the 2015 Fringe Festival. More at fringearts.com.
You turn to WHYY for exceptional coverage of the day's events and exciting storytelling. As Philadelphia prepares to welcome Pope Francis, we're investigating everything from the cultural and historical impact to need-to-know logistics, what it means for the world, the region, the city, and you. In the weeks ahead, stay with WHYY for ongoing reporting on the Pope's visit and find all of our special coverage and online features in one place at whyy.org/pope in Philly.
Once upon a time, war bonds helped the country pay to fight World War II.
It would be nice today to have celebrities and movie stars getting behind the government, if not for a war effort, to maybe finding some way to save America.
Coming up, why Miley Cyrus isn't going to be hawking war bonds anytime soon. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Philadelphia area resident Randy Garbin is a website developer by day. During off hours, he turns his artistic eye toward the dwindling number of diners in our area. Randy, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And certainly the architecture is one component of a diner, but let's get a working definition. What's a diner?
Well, I've always concentrated on a rather strict definition that a diner is a prefabricated structure with counter service hauled out to a remote setting. They are typically made in factories, and they were bought like automobiles by budding entrepreneurs who wanted to get into the restaurant business. And they set them up in their neighborhoods or in their towns, and they were kind of like turnkey businesses. The builders would plop them down on site. You'd hook up the utilities. They even came with the dishes. All you had to do was order the food for them, and within a couple of weeks, you were open for business.
But they weren't literally diner cars from a railroad.
No. The term diner and the design of them, the style of them, is derived from the railroad, but you could call it kind of a marketing gimmick because if you saw something that looked like a train on the side of the road, it's going to catch your eye. And back in the 20s and earlier, it was considered quite fashionable to eat on the train. If you had a meal on a train, you were riding on one of the crack trains, you know, and so it emulated the experience.
Now, our listeners of a certain age might well think that diners originated in the Philadelphia, New Jersey area,
no.
But not so.
No, the lineage of the diner building industry started in Providence, Rhode Island in 1872. A guy by the name of Walter Scott converted a horse-drawn lunch wagon into something where he could stand inside of and serve food, not unlike all the food trucks that you see on the street corners here in Philadelphia. And from there, other people saw what he was doing and decided to set up a factory to sell these things for others to set up somewhere. And the lunch wagon evolved into something bigger and bigger until finally, you know, long story short, they became these giant stainless steel multi-section palaces that you often saw on the roadside.
Now let's talk more specifically about remaining diners in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Is the number staying constant?
When I first came to Philly in the early 90s, I think there were about 35. And in my article, I think it's now down to about 24. So we lost quite a few. And of the number remaining, some of the more beautiful ones that I found there have been renovated to look like something completely different. So the preservation factor has been seriously as hurt, for lack of a better term. There's by some of the owners, a tremendous lack of appreciation for what it is that they have. Now, they do this because they think that their market is going to respond to, you know, something that's newer and fresher. But, you know, it's an open question. Sometimes if you just, you know, shine the place up, give it a good cleaning and fix up what was original, your neighborhood's going to love you just as much, if not more.
I'm looking across at my producer. He's in his 20s. Is it your sense that our younger listeners will become enthralled by diners, or do you have to be of a certain age to understand the experience more fully?
You know, I was never really pessimistic about this kind of thing, but I tend to think that, you know, the younger generations are probably going to start leaving diners behind because too many owners are not kind of keeping up with the latest food trends. In the larger diners, the 200-seat ones, you still see the giant menus that, you know, supposedly specialize in everything ever made, and they're very, very heavy on meat and potatoes. But I think that if you're in your young, you know, in your early 20s or so, you know, you're looking for healthier items. You're looking for a place that's even associated with healthier foods. And the other problem is that if you're older, if you're in your 60s, your doctor is telling you not to eat that food. So they're going to kind of get squeezed from both ends. And unless there is a major wholesale changes in attitudes in the industry, you know, it doesn't look good. Let's just put it that way.
Is food merely a component for you in the gestalt experience of
it really
diner?
Is. I you know, in my article, I say that, look, I give especially vintage diners, I give them a lot of slack because I know how hard it is. When I go into a new place, there's certain things that I'll order. And I am particular about a few things. I think that a good diner should always serve really good coffee. And for breakfast, they should serve really good home fries. If you can't do those two things, then maybe you're in the wrong business. But most of all, I go in just to get a sense of the atmosphere. And if I'm in a new place, I can't think of a better way to introduce yourself to the neighborhood than to walk into a great local diner.
Randy, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's been great. Thanks, Dave.
Jenkintown resident Randy Garbin is a website designer by day and aficionado of diners always. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight. A piece of art shipped to Philadelphia from Africa is stuck in customs because of its unusual material. The sculpture is made entirely from guns. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives is insisting that the sculpture be destroyed by the collector who bought it.
The artwork is called War Throne. It was made by an artist in Mozambique named Goncalo Mabunda. He makes sculpture by welding together decommissioned weapons that were used during the Civil War in Mozambique between 1977 and 1992. His chairs are made of rifle parts, hand grenade casings, mortar shells, and the barrels of large caliber artillery. One of his chairs caught the eye of Adam Solo. He's a Philadelphia attorney, and he collects African art for its vibrant color and its political messaging.
I mean, he's taking things that were used to kill and maim people, and he's trying to make them to objects of beauty or to make you think about the things that happened in his country and moving on from that war.
Solo bought one of the war thrones for just over $8,000, and it triggered red flags when it came through U.S. Customs. Officials turned the chair over to the ATF, which insists it be destroyed. Anthony Tropea, an ATF special agent in Philadelphia, says as long as the parts can be removed and repurposed as weaponry, the chair is a threat.
For example, those two grenades that sit atop of this particular piece of art, if they can be removed mechanically and someone were to obtain explosives powder, then this device would no longer be inert. It would become, in fact, a destructive device.
Other chairs by Goncalo Mabunda have been shipped without incident to a New York art gallery, and right now the Brooklyn Museum has one on display. That collector, Adam Solo, plans to file a suit in federal court this week to force the ATF to release the chair, arguing that the chair does not comply with the federal government's own definition of what constitutes a firearm. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Tomorrow, Ars Nova Workshop founder Mark Christman previews the Experimental Music Organization's 15th season. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.